United States against Guevara. Mr. Sklarsky.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel for the government, counsel for co-defendant appellants. My name is Charles Sklarsky. I represent Jerome Genova. Defendant appellants have divided their time equally. In the 10 minutes that I have this morning, I will address instruction 30A and rely on our briefs as to the other counts of the indictment and arguments that we raise. Instruction 30A informed the jury as follows. Official misconduct is a separate form of bribery under Illinois law. That instruction infected all of the predicate acts and the count of mail fraud for conviction. Of the 52 predicate acts and sub-acts that were in the indictment, 6 survived the trial and post-trial motions.
Could I ask you a clarification question? You mentioned in your reply brief that there was a revised indictment.
Yes.
And the government's appendix had an indictment. I take it that's not the revised indictment that you're referring to?
I honestly don't know what the government's appendix had in it, but before we went to the jury, the revised indictment, there were 4 subparts to official misconduct. Mm-hmm. 2 of those subparts were stricken. Our argument doesn't rely necessarily on the fact that they struck 2 of the subparts of official misconduct, because if any one of those subparts was not a form of bribery, instruction 30A was incorrect. Because instruction 30A is far sweeping. It says any form of official misconduct is bribery. And it wouldn't matter if one of the subparts of official misconduct that was initially charged in the indictment, or even a subpart of official misconduct that went to the jury, happened to also be bribery, because the subpart involving filing of false statements was not a subpart of the, was not bribery. And the instruction, therefore, misled the jury. Because as it turned out, what happened here was the jury returned guilty verdict findings on 4 predicate acts of bribery, 2 predicate acts of mail fraud. And the mail fraud, the scheme to defraud, was the very bribery that was the same conduct involved.
But why do you say that? Why does the mail fraud conviction necessarily follow what happens to bribery? Because even if you're right, and that bribery doesn't include things like the filing of the false statements, certainly mail fraud covers schemes to defraud using illegal things. It is not only bribery is underlying.
Well, that's correct. Although in this case, the only scheme to defraud that was relevant was the bribery scheme. There's no dispute about that. The government argued it, and I believe even in the government's brief, they concede that the scheme to defraud that the mail fraud was the subject of was the bribery scheme.
But
we discussed this at the trial court, and under Bloom, if this is a mailing of a statement of economic interest, it was alleged that there was false information on that statement. Under Bloom, there has to be, the scheme to defraud would not be cognizable under the mail fraud statute if it simply takes a false statement and the mailing of it would not convert that into a mail fraud cognizable under the statute. There has to be personal gain. There has to be a violation of a known legal duty. That's where Bloom has come out. And the only scheme that was alleged was the bribery scheme. So we don't know. In light of Instruction 38, it is impossible to know whether the jury found Genova guilty of mail fraud because they believed he had filed a false statement, a subject about which there was not a lot of dispute at trial, versus whether he had taken kickbacks from Galata, a subject about which there was substantial dispute at trial. And Instruction 30A blurred the distinction. As we sit here today, we can't know. And it would be unfair to guess Genova into a conviction based on what might have happened. Instruction 30A, the bribery instructions were correct, the official misconduct instructions were correct, but Instruction 30A blurred the distinction between all of them.
But just because the kickback arrangements with the Galata law firm might not have fallen within some concept of bribery doesn't mean necessarily to me that lies about it on a financial disclosure statement couldn't be part of a predicate mail fraud offense?
Lies about it, if there was an underlying bribery scheme, a lie about it could be in furtherance of the bribery scheme.
Well, I'm just trying to get you to delete the word bribery from that. If there was an underlying scheme to have this back and forth between, you know, Geneva and Galata with respect to the exchange of legal business and so forth,
right,
which was not disclosed on the form, which I take it nobody's really arguing about that. It wasn't disclosed
right
on the form. That's dishonest, and if that financial relationship, whatever its legal box may be, is continued because of this concealment, why can't that, and it's done by use of the mails, et cetera,
right,
why?
Because all forms of dishonesty coupled with the mailing are not cognizable under the mail fraud statute. That's what this circuit court has held. That's what many other circuits have held. Bloom is, I believe, the latest and most recent case on that.
And
I know that's your honest case.
A scheme to defraud the city out of the mayor's honest services, or a scheme to defraud the city out of its money, which are other reasonable characterizations of this behavior, is certainly mail fraud.
I don't disagree with that. But the only scheme that was alleged, and the only scheme about which evidence was presented, was the bribery scheme.
When you say
that's
the only
scheme, that's just a different phrase for the scheme to defraud the city out of a lot of money.
Yes, but the underlying conduct is that he took kickbacks from Galata.
But
and if we don't
know, I look at the indictment, and it, you know, unfortunately the indictment, which is not, you know, the world's most thrilling reading, has you finally get to the mail fraud counts, you know, rather late in the day in the indictment, and it incorporates by reference earlier paragraphs that have been set forth in more detail what's going on in the RICO parts of it. But I at least understood it to mean that kind of all this stuff taken together was also mail fraud. You know, here are the dates the letters are mailed and so on. And so I guess I'm a little troubled by the notion that the only scheme alleged was what you want to call the bribery scheme, as opposed to sort of the package of facts in the indictment that the government was partially characterizing as a bribery scheme, it might also have been characterizing as something else.
The only thing the mailing had anything to do with was this failure to disclose the relationship with Galata. And the only thing about the relationship with Galata that was in any sense dishonest or fraudulent was the bribery relationship with Galata. The mailing had nothing to do with the home repairs, it had nothing to do with the comp time, it had nothing to do with any of those
things. Representation?
I'm sorry?
I mean, conflict-free representation? You don't think this sort of secret arrangement with Galata was depriving the city of information it should have had about where its lawyer's loyalties lay?
No, and I don't think that was even argued.
Absent
money? No, because I don't believe that. If there had not been an exchange of money, which is what makes it the bribery, and if for political reasons, for example, the mayor, Geneva, decided not to disclose his relationship with Galata because he didn't want his political opponents to know that, and he mailed the statement of economic interest, I don't believe under this court's case law that that would be recognized as a mail fraud. There has to be some financial aspect to it. There has to be some element of personal gain and political advantage or simply a breach of some fiduciary obligation coupled with the mailing is not going to be recognizable as a mail fraud. There has to be a violation of a known legal duty and generally coupled with some sort of gain. And that's as I read Bloom, what it held. And I give as an example a concealment with respect to political reasons or for political purposes coupled with the mailing would not be enough to convert what is a misdemeanor under Illinois state law into a federal felony of mail fraud. My time is done. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Sklarsky. Mr. Hill.
Thank you. Good morning. I represent Lawrence Galata, and Lawrence Galata is saying that with respect to count one, that because he was charged under 1962C, that it was necessary for the government to show that he was indeed a director or manager of the enterprise. This case is somewhat analogous to the case decided by this court, the Swan case, where the court talked about the fact that without getting into whether or not there's a scheme or without challenging whether or not the government proved that or not, you've got to at a minimum show that this defendant was a director of the enterprise. Now, the enterprise in this case is Calumet City. Lawrence Galato was a prosecutor. He's a village prosecutor. He's not the mayor. He was not department head. He was an outside contractor who worked for the city. He had nothing to do with passing legislation or hiring police chiefs or even settling litigation without the city council's permission.
But this court's cases don't require somebody to be the czar of the enterprise. You can, as long as you have or participate directly or indirectly in the control, which surely Mr. Galata did as city prosecutor and as somebody with kind of an inside relationship. He didn't have to be the only one, in other words.
Oh, absolutely not. But he was not even on, as we expressed in our brief, he wasn't even on the totem pole of director. It's not like we're saying he's at the lower rung or in the middle rung. He's not even in the enterprise. He's outside. He's comparable, I would say, to the accounting firm in Reeves or Revis Ernst Young, the U.S. Supreme Court case.
But he's the city prosecutor.
Yes, but the city prosecutor makes decisions regarding whether or not you should get a ticket for not cutting your grass. Okay? Whether or not you should get a parking ticket because you're a scufflaw. Okay, these are things that the city hires someone to do to raise revenue for the city. It's like a collection firm, respectfully, and it's like a collection firm in many small municipalities. They rely heavily upon their traffic ticket revenue. They rely upon code enforcement. That has absolutely nothing to do with the administration of the enterprise. I mean, I'm sorry, the direction and decision-making regarding the enterprise. Aldermen, maybe, yes. Mayors, maybe, yes. Department heads, even assistant department heads or sub-managers. But Larry Galata doesn't fall within that stricture. He's not within that enterprise. And the law says that if you're going to charge him under 1962C, insider, I would kind of call that insider RICO violations. Now, they have the option of going with 1962A and B and maybe even D, but they didn't. But once you use 1962C, and I'm not trying to use that as a technicality, what I'm saying is that that's the law. They prepared the charging instrument. They made the decision. There was no conspiracy alleged here. So you can't say you get it by virtue of an agreement. In Swan, the defendant in Swan was charged with 1962C and aiding and abetting.
Could I ask you, you mentioned just now there's no conspiracy charge, and there certainly is not.
Yes.
And with respect to Mr. Galata, I was a little surprised that you did not seem to take issue with the government's proposition that Pinkerton liability brings Mr. Galata into the ambit of Mr. Genova's false filings.
Right.
Saw Pinkerton. I went back and looked at it again this morning. Pinkerton's about conspiracy.
Correct.
Why is Pinkerton liability pertinent to Mr. Galata's knowledge?
I took that reading to mean that they were using Pinkerton, albeit maybe slightly incorrectly, as to deal with the issue of foreseeability. That's how they brought it into this case, that it was reasonably foreseeable that Larry Galata would know that Jerry Genova was going to file some irregular statements of economic interest. They were using it for purposes of foreseeability.
Right, and he's liable for foreseeable things, what, as part of the
mail fraud? As well as part of, to the extent that you use those as predicate acts under the RICO.
So where's the case that says Pinkerton applies to mail fraud?
I don't think that it does. I don't think that it does. I just read that to mean that they were talking foreseeability. There's clearly no conspiracy in this case, and Pinkerton, as you've indicated, does refer to that. Maybe they were trying to use it to show aiding and abetting. I don't know. I didn't
I thought what was more important was that the facts didn't show that it was foreseeable to Galata. Galata filed 1099s. He disclosed this information on his filings. He sent 1099s to Mr. Genova, and
yeah.
He also filed the appropriate paperwork with the government. And in fact, looking at the economic interest statements, they could have been prepared in such a way. I mean, I don't think that there was any requirement that you say what law firm you work for. Maybe you could have just said, I work for a law firm. There was some discussion from a witness who was called from the city by the government to testify as to what are the requirements for filling out these forms. Her name slips me right now. But she said that there's no particular way to do it. So to make the leap that respectfully the district court made to say, well, it was obvious that he knew that he was going to be filling out improper economic interest statements, that's really pushing it. There's no evidence of that. And for that reason, Galata should be found not guilty of counts 2, 3, and 4, which deal with the mail frauds. He should also be found not guilty of count 1, for the same reasons that he should be found not guilty of 2, 3, and 4, and an additional reason being the fact that they haven't shown that he was the director or manager of the enterprise. There's another reason also with respect to the RICO. You've got to show at least 2 separate and distinct acts. I'm relying primarily on the first one because I know that reasonable persons can differ with respect to how you should construe distinct acts. But it would be our position that there was only one crime here. To the extent that you accept that there was a fraud going on the city, that was the one crime. The fact that he got payments over a period of months was how he was paid. Didn't constitute separate and independent offenses. The offense was made from its inception. It's the fact that it took, it was kind of an artificial making of 4 predicate acts. The government decides to say, well, we're going to turn it into 4 predicate acts by using the economic interest statement filing requirements each year. And I'm saying that that's an artificial distinction, one that is not consistent with what these facts are. I've got 5 minutes also on my closing. I'd like to say one thing briefly about the theft. Under 5 and 6, this man was doing an honest day's job. He was doing work. There was no question regarding the work. Now, whether or not he got it, honestly, that's a different question. But he was doing work. There was never any complaint about his job, what he was doing, the value that he was bringing. He was collecting those tickets. He was doing what he was hired to do. So to say that he's guilty of theft is another stretch. And under 18 U.S.C. 666, bona fide salary, wages, what have you, based for professional services, you can't call that theft. It's not a violation of 666. And I thank you for your time, and I'll sit down now for a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Mr. Martin.
Good morning, Your Honors. I represent Jerome Stick. There's a saying, I'm not too sure whether it's old or not, but the saying goes, if it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, must be a duck. In this case, the government has taken the duck of theft and it has called it bribery. The significant issue for Mr. Stack is whether this court is going to put its stamp of approval upon the government's creative and novel use of Illinois' bribery statute. The jury struggled with the government's theory. Question after question came out of the jury room dealing with bribery. At one point, the jury wanted a dictionary. The next wanted a definition of bribery. The judge couldn't give them the definition of bribery because it was defined by Illinois law. And then
any cases that you know of in Illinois or other states on whether diverting public employees' time to private ends is bribery?
What I know is that there are no cases that the government found in the district court.
I'm not asking whether the government found.
Right.
I'm asking what you found.
I didn't find any cases. Mm-hmm. I struggled with this from the onset of the case. It's almost like the test for pornography that Justice Potter Stewart wrote in the case. I'm not too sure what it is, but I know it when I see it. In this case, I may not be too sure what bribery is, but I know it when I see it. And what Mr. Stack...
Well, look, we need to be a little more rigorous than that. And for things like a RICO violation, for example, we know from even the recent case in Shidler against Now that the Taylor test that the Supreme Court uses is still good law, that we're supposed to kind of get this generic idea, if you will. This circuit has said, you know, it doesn't depend so much on the labels that state law puts on it, depends on what this is. The Illinois statute, as I understand, is pertinent to Mr. Stack, talks about an act to influence the performance of any act related to the employment or function of any public officer, then if you promise or tender some property or personal advantage. And I take it your argument is that whatever else was going on, it wasn't something related to these people's employment.
That's one of our arguments. I really have two arguments with respect to the Illinois statute. The first argument, and it's probably not as strong as my other argument. The first argument is that Mr. Stack wasn't influencing how these employees were picking up garbage. He wasn't telling, you know, go in front of the mayor's house and do an extra good job with the garbage cans. Nothing like that. There wasn't influence of their official duties. Here we're talking about people who work for the Public Works Department. Their job was to clean streets, to beautify the city. That was their job. So he wasn't trying to influence their jobs per se. But there's another provision in the Illinois statute, and that states that the public employee, the person who accepted the bribe, must be unauthorized by law to accept that payment. And what we take that language to mean is that the payment, when you think of bribery, usually is money aside from your public salary.
But why are you authorized by law? I mean, suppose just a simple case where somebody says, if you go distribute Girl Scout cookies for my daughter, I'll let you take the week off, but I'll file time cards that say you were here at work, so you'll get your full salary for that week. Surely you're not authorized by law to accept that salary.
Well,
even though it's maybe a worthy thing you were doing with your time, it's still fraud.
If you're a duly authorized city employee, you're authorized to pick up your paycheck, you're authorized to...
Even if you lied, you know, in order to get it and filed phony time cards?
Well, that's the point. This may be a crime. Mail fraud. Usually ghost payrolling or having city workers do political work on city time, it's usually charged as mail fraud.
And you're just saying it's a different crime. It may not be a good thing to do, but it's not bribery.
Exactly. And yeah. What we said in the district court is it's a theft of services situation. The services of these city employees, it was a theft. But it has importance for purposes of the RICO violation because 1961-1, which lists all the predicate acts that can be charged, does not list theft, does not list Section 666. And Your Honor mentioned generic bribery. Well, the government hasn't pointed us to a single case in which someone's salary is the basis of a bribe payment, is the bribe payment. I found no case. The district judge found no case. In the briefs, we find no case. I looked as hard as I could. The best I could find was reference to the common law where they talk about bribes or something that comes from other than the king. That's all I could find. But when you look at generic bribery, is this generic bribery? We would suggest not. That has ramifications for the official misconduct. Official misconduct also is not a predicate act in 1961-1, but as the Supreme Court confirmed recently in the Shidler case, that it's the generic conduct that counts, not the label. But you have to look, is this official misconduct, does it generically resemble bribery? And if there's no case that says that you can bribe someone with their salary, it's not generic bribery. It might be illegal. It might be a crime. It may violate theft and mail fraud, but it doesn't violate the bribery statute. It's not generic bribery. With respect to the official misconduct charges, because those are the other acts Mr. Stack was convicted of, they included bribery. Because if you look at the language of the charging instrument, they say that Mr. Stack committed bribery, and it tailors the language of the official misconduct statute, and that it lists by performing acts in excess of his lawful authority, including, and it lists, I think, three Illinois statutes, including bribery. The jury didn't get instructions on any of the other statute other than bribery. The jury was told that bribery and official misconduct were forms of bribery under the Illinois bribery statute, and Mr. Geneva has devoted his argument to that. Your Honor, we also objected to the ostrich instruction as to Mr. Stack. One of the points we make is that the government didn't cite evidence of deliberate avoidance, and I see I'm now into my rebuttal time, and I am across the appellee, so I have to reserve some of it, but I would just ask where the evidence of deliberate avoidance by Mr. Stack is in this record. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bindi.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. David Bindi for the United States. Your Honors, I'd like to take the arguments in the order that they were presented by the appellant. So I'll start with Mr. Geneva. Mr. Geneva's complaint here today is that he was prejudiced by Instruction 30A, which is an instruction that explicitly and exclusively pertained to a racketeering act on which Mr. Geneva was acquitted by the district court. His argument, therefore, is necessarily that this instruction somehow bled into and spilled over onto the other predicate acts in the RICO charge. And this is simply an untenable argument because the other predicate acts, the mail frauds and the briberies, each came with their own set of instructions.
But, yeah, I mean, that's where I was trying to get to the bottom of whether... if we thought that there was a problem with the bribery definition or with the bribery convictions, how, if at all, does that carry over to the mail fraud parts of this case?
I don't see how it could, Your Honor.
Because his argument, as I understand it, is if you look at the indictment as a whole, the mail fraud is based upon this scheme by which Galata kicked back, you know, whatever it was, a third of the money, and then he sent the contract over to Galata, which suggests, at least as the district court saw it, that Galata was bribing Geneva for the contract.
Well, I think it's quite clear that the jury understood all that. I mean, they understood that the essence of the crime committed as between Geneva and Galata was this corrupt relationship, this attorney fee kickback scheme, and that it violated the law in a couple of different ways. It violated the mail fraud statute, it violated the Illinois bribery statute, and it violated, as alleged in the indictment anyway, the Illinois official misconduct statute.
But I don't see how the official misconduct statute in subpart C overlaps with generic bribery at all. I mean, your definition, your brief, was staggeringly broad. Staggeringly broad. Anything dishonest, basically, turns into a bribe. I guess bank robbery must be bribery, too. I mean, that's a dishonest thing.
Well, the Garner case does say that efforts to corrupt a public official...
In the context of a case where there was bribery going on, the Garner case says, look at what is happening. Look at the facts, as I read it anyway.
Okay, but there's bribery going on here, too, and that was one of the predicate... a RICO predicate that's alleged and that the jury found and that the district court upheld. And it came with its own set of instructions. The instructions on the official misconduct predicates were different. And even though it was preceded by that instruction that said that official misconduct is a separate form of bribery, it said separate form.
But that's not right. Some official misconduct may be and some may not be.
Technically, that's correct.
But yeah, I mean, what are we doing but being technical, though? It's the criminal conviction.
Okay, but what my argument here is that even if the instruction misstated the law as to Geneva, it didn't bleed into and infect the instructions on the other predicate acts that the jury found. the instructions on bribery under Illinois law covered bribery under Illinois law, and those instructions told the jury that if you promise or tender to a public official something of value, intending to influence his official conduct, then you've committed bribery under Illinois law. And that's exactly what Genova did here, or what Gulotta and Genova were engaged in here.
Well, of course, if the jury is told one thing in one breath and something else in the next, it's different. I wonder, just as a quick sidelight, could you clarify for me this reference in the reply brief that I asked about earlier to a revised indictment that deletes two of the official misconduct? There are transcript sites. Is there a copy of this revised? It sounds like, I don't know if it's a superseding indictment or what it is.
Your Honor, I must confess that if that's in the record, I missed it. I was going with the indictment that was in the record, and I frankly am unaware that portions of that of those racketeering acts were altered in the version of the indictment that went back to the jury.
Yeah, they gave. We need to know this. They gave transcript sites, so I guess let's check it out.
I apologize, Your Honor. I just don't know.
Okay.
with respect to Mr. Gulotta's argument, he argues first that you can't be found to have conducted or participated directly or indirectly in the conducting the affairs of a RICO enterprise unless you're an insider, basically. On the totem pole, I believe is the way he put it. the United States Supreme Court disagrees with that. It said in the Rivas case that someone who is not in the structure of an enterprise can nevertheless participate in the enterprise's affairs through bribery, which is exactly what Gulotta did here. He influenced the enterprise, the city, to perform a certain act, hiring him and his law firm. And he influenced that decision through bribery, and that's exactly what RICO is intended to address. He says that the Swan case controls the outcome of this case. He relies heavily on Swan on this issue. But you have to remember that the conviction in Swan was not reversed based on insufficient evidence to show that the defendant had conducted or participated in conducting the affairs of the enterprise. It was reversed because of an erroneous jury instruction on that issue.
Could we move to the mail fraud part? Because there I want to follow up on my concern about your use of Pinkerton, which it seems to me is confusing apples and oranges. It's not at all clear to me that Gulotta had any reason to expect anything in Genova's completion of these financial or these disclosure statements. I've filled out legions of disclosure statements in my own career, some for the Department of Justice, some for here, some for other places, and they all ask for different things, and they all ask at different levels of disability. And sitting here today, I couldn't tell you what Cook County wants, and so I don't know why Gulotta should have known that.
Because he's an expert in municipal law.
So what? I mean, you probably are an expert in all manner of law, and I'm not sure that means you've memorized every form that every agency uses. I wouldn't expect you to have done. And I'm also, at a conceptual level, not sure why Pinkerton.
My expectations of Mr. Bindi are greater. I expect you to have memorized every form you use.
Well,
you're sure to be disappointed.
No, and I didn't mean that as a criticism at all, but just as a realistic comment. But why does a conspiracy case, Pinkerton, plug in? What case says that Pinkerton is the source of the legal standard that somebody accused of mail fraud, who's involved in a scheme that may also include other people, where's the case that says that's the right standard?
Well, Your Honor, I don't have a case right off the top of my head, but we made the argument because the issue here is reasonable foreseeability. And in order for Pinkerton or any conspiracy principle to apply in a case, it's not necessary that there be a conspiracy charge in the case.
Well, that's true with co-conspirator testimony, but you're talking about a substantive element of a case. You didn't charge conspiracy.
That's true, we didn't.
So I'm... I'm well aware of the evidentiary rules, but I'm not sure how much further we're entitled to take that.
I don't really think, Your Honor, that the reference to Pinkerton changes the calculus, because the argument is essentially the same thing with or without Pinkerton in the mix. It is that Geneva's mailing of the false financial disclosure statements was something that was reasonably foreseeable to Galata.
Can I ask you at what level of generality you're making this argument? Because two seem possible to me. One is that Galata had reason to expect that Geneva was going to lie on his financial disclosure statements every year that he's required to file with Cook County. Another possibility is you might be arguing that Galata expected that Geneva would do everything necessary wherever it came up to conceal their illegal arrangement, whether it was financial disclosure statements, whether it was not mentioning it to the city council, whether it was whatever it was. And which of those levels of generality are you operating at?
Well, with regard to the mail fraud predicates and substantive counts, I'm specifically focused on the idea that Galata knew that the financial disclosure that Geneva was required to make included disclosure of outside sources of income. I mean, that's just the standard thing for a public official to have to disclose, an elected official to have to disclose. He knew that. He knew that...
You're just assuming that because you assume he was a good lawyer. We have no particular evidence that he actually knew it.
This is what the district court found.
District court said that, but we're reviewing the district court's opinion. So
okay.
I'm just trying to find out what evidentiary base might have been there.
Well, the district court specifically relied on the fact that Galata had spent a great deal of his career practicing municipal law, and that it would be natural for him to be aware of the disclosure requirements of elected public officials at the municipal level.
But municipal law might be municipal bond issues. I mean, there are all sorts of things that municipal law might encompass.
That's entirely true.
We don't know.
But, well...
Anyway, it was an assumption. That's all right. I don't mean
okay.
to belabor this point.
He also knew that there was no way that Geneva could disclose the financial relationship that he had with Galata on the form. That would expose the corrupt relationship. And as for the mailing itself, Calumet City is down on the Indiana border. The Cook County Clerk's office is on, I think, Washington Street here in Chicago. That's reasonably foreseeable. Mr. Galata is also arguing here today that the crime really is a unitary one. That what he and Geneva engaged in was entirely involved in this attorney fee kickback scheme, and therefore you don't have the kind of multiple crimes that RICO requires. The Torres and O'Connor cases that this court has decided say otherwise. They say that multiple bribes in furtherance of a single scheme to defraud or harm or injure a single victim spread out over time constitute a RICO pattern. Mr. Galata also contests the theft counts on the ground that he did the work that he was paid for. The government's position, and the district court accepted this, was that the entire relationship was corrupt and the city never got what it was paying for. It was paying for conflict-free representation. And from the beginning of this relationship, it never got that. Mr. Stack argues that what he engaged in with regard to the city employees who were doing political work on city time and for comp time was not bribery.
I want to stop on that, too, because I don't see how these comp time payments were related to any act related to the employment or function of the public employee. I can see how getting comp time for no work is a personal advantage, so I'm not worried about that. But it seems to me that while it's certainly not legal to pay people who are on the public payroll for work they don't do, it's not like you said, we're going to pay you an extra $100 so that you'll collect three times a week the garbage from this influential person's neighborhood, and the people who don't ante up an extra $20 don't get their garbage collected at all, et cetera. All of those I would have no problem seeing. Or to take something that I'm sure you're all very familiar with, you know, if somebody shows up and says, I want a commercial driver's license, and you say, that'll be $20, fine. You know, that sounds a lot like bribery. But comp time, so that someone can go paint campaign signs or lying on timesheets, how does that become bribery?
Well, it certainly affects the public employee's employment, because it is through his employment that he is recruited to
but
do this.
That's not the word. The performance of any act related to the employment, which act related to their employment was influenced? How were they pushed to exercise their discretion in the public works department one way or the other by this essentially fraud on the government?
Well, certainly when they were doing city or political work on city time during the regular work week.
That's bribery?
Why is that bribery? Suppose instead the supervisor says, we don't have very much work left to do. It's 3 o'clock. You're supposed to work till 5. Go home early and go fix your garage. And the employee goes home early, gets paid for 2 hours of city work he didn't do, and fixes his garage. Is that bribery?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't think so.
Why is that any different than this?
The difference
one
here
can infer that comp time has the same effect as being paid, and the work is, instead of fixing the garage, it's fix up the campaign signs.
The difference here is that the defendants are inducing the employees to do something that benefits them. And they're offering an inducement that the employees are not entitled to receive.
Stack, when he sends the employee home 2 hours early, thinks it benefits him to have a happier workforce.
And I don't see the benefit him element in this Illinois statute. It's just not there. It's with intent to influence the performance of any act related to the employment or function, and you promise to that person a personal advantage. It doesn't say that will also benefit the promisor. I don't see that as an element.
Well, Your Honor,
that's why my Girl Scout cookie example is the same thing. There are all kinds of things you could do on time that you get off from work, some of which may have to do with political campaigns, of course, but some of which may have to do with other things.
Well,
where does this statute distinguish?
I think, Your Honor, it has to do with, if you look at the elements one at a time, there has to be an intent to influence the employee's performance of his official duties. And we think that certainly with respect to the political work on city time, they're being influenced to abandon their duties. They are in effect.
Oh, well, whoa, 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 whoa. Influenced to abandon their duties. Suppose, to take some entirely hypothetical situation, that some law school would offer a federal judge an opportunity to teach a class during working hours, and the judge, in exchange for pay, accepts that and goes and teaches a class during working hours, thus abandoning his duties. Is that bribery?
Does this judge have a name, Your Honor?
Well, there might be several on this court.
Okay.
In fact, there are lots. But it looked to me like your definition of bribery made that transaction in which the judge, and you can come up with a long list, it's teaching, going to a workshop, and being reimbursed for expenses. There are lots of things that public employees do, not just judges and not just with law schools, that take place during working hours that could be said to divert time, that often involve payment, and yet one doesn't think of them as bribery. Now, Congress has passed a statute controlling those activities not by defining them as crimes, but by setting a cap on the total amount of outside earned income that can be made by a federal employee. But if I understand your view, it's bribery. It's a federal felony. So we don't get to the outside earned income cap.
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. Because the terms of the employment of a federal judge are different from the terms of employment of an hourly worker who has to punch a clock.
The same rules apply to hourly workers. That is, an hourly worker could decide to write a novel on the side or try to patent something and accept outside income for it. It happens all the time. In fact, the Supreme Court has made it clear that for hourly workers, these kinds of rules are the same rules. I don't think there's anything in the distinction between hourly workers and salary workers that affects your definition of bribery, or for that matter, the application of the federal rules about outside earned income.
Well, Your Honor, we've made our argument in our brief, and it relies heavily on the reasoning of the district court, who found that the elements of Illinois state bribery were present here. I've done my best to answer your questions on that issue, and I'd like to move on with my remaining time to the government's cross appeal with respect to Mr. Stack.
I don't think you need to spend any time on the cross appeal. I at least would appreciate it if you would spend some time on the forfeiture.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Genova.
Unless my colleague wants to.
No, Judge Easterbrook and I will discuss your cross appeal. Judge Mannion, there's a case that pertains to your cross appeal that we've both had some contact with.
Very well. With regard to forfeiture, Geneva makes an argument that the money representing the comp time and the money representing the increased value of his home should not have been ordered forfeited. He also argues that the gross.
Let's think of the increased value of a home.
Okay.
How much of that is the value of materials that Geneva contributed, and how much of that is the value of the work that was put in by the public employee?
I don't think it matters, Your Honor. And the reason I don't think it matters is because when we're talking about RICO forfeiture, we're talking about recouping ill-gotten gains.
And exactly. So if Geneva puts a pile of $55,000 on the ground and the public employees unlawfully add $5,000 to it, how much is ill-gotten gains? Answer is $5,000.
Correct.
Why is it any different if it's building materials rather than money?
Well, we don't really have very much in the way of evidence on what Geneva spent for building materials. What we have is evidence that his home increased in value as a result of this to the tune of $60,000.
Right, but Mr. Bundy, I just finished having hardwood floors put down in my house, and I paid a certain amount for the materials, and I paid a certain amount for the services of the people who actually put them down. And I think that's the question Judge Easterbrook is getting at.
One can distinguish these two things as components of value.
I
and indeed, our decision of United States against Shepherd seems to require district judges to distinguish those two components of value.
I understand that position.
It's not a position. It's a holding.
Okay.
How can the position, which you are taking, be reconciled with the holding of Shepherd?
I understand Geneva's argument to be not that a portion of this should be backed out. In other words, cost of building materials, because my recollection of the record is that there was very, very little submitted in terms of evidence on costs that went into this home improvement.
And whose burden is that?
I think that...
Is this viewed as a... properly as part of the prosecutor's case, or are you conceiving of it as an affirmative defense?
I'm conceiving of it as an affirmative defense because
it's a known factor. Why under the statute would it be an affirmative defense?
Well, it's a known factor that there's a $60,000 gain in the value of the house. Something is forfeitable. If the defendant...
Didn't he testify that he paid for the materials? I mean,
pardon
I thought me? There was something before the district court, his testimony or something, that he said he paid for the materials.
I think there was some evidence, some very limited evidence regarding the cost of materials.
Right, but anyway, I mean, I had the same burden of proof question that Judge Easterbrook did about who needed to do this.
Well, you know, if the government has to come up with figures on what the defendant's costs were for any of it to be forfeitable, and the government does not come up with any figures for what the costs were, then the question is becomes whether it's all forfeitable or none of it forfeitable, even though there were costs.
That depends on who has the burden of proof.
That depends on who has the burden of proof. I think the defendant, if he wants...
One could say, I suppose, that the prosecutor has the burden of persuasion, but the defendant has a burden of production.
That would be, I think, a reasonable way of looking at it. I think at least once the government has presented evidence that there is an ill-gotten gain here, and we did that, and the gain is $60,000.
It's a gain of $60,000 only if that's gravy. There's an increase in value of $60,000. The thing on the table is whether it is a gain or simply a transmutation of form of Geneva's own assets from cash to mortar.
And I think that that's where the defendant has at least a burden of production. He's got to come forward with something.
All right.
To show that
now let me ask you about the law firm's fees and the forfeiture of them. Let me give you a hypothetical. Suppose something that would never occur in Chicago. Suppose a construction contractor gets a job building a highway as a result of a bribe, and it's paid $100 million to build a highway, and builds the highway, and it kicks back $5 million, spends $95 million on concrete and so on, and it's convicted under RICO. How much is the forfeiture?
I think the forfeiture is in that situation, the amount of, not the total amount, it's the amount that is the overpayment, the overcharging, in order to get
the $5 million dollar overcharge and not the total cost of the highway.
Correct.
So, but then what is the rationale why Gulata and the law firm are ordered to forfeit the entire amount they received as fees, even on the supposition that they furnished legal services? Now, their legal services may be worth only two-thirds of the total fees. The rest was kicked back. But the forfeiture is of the whole amount.
Well, the public agency that enters into a contract to build a highway and gets a highway, but at an inflated cost, has been cheated out of the inflated cost.
Exactly. And
a city that contracts for legal services and gets legal
services has been cheated out of the excess price, but got the legal services. It's intangible.
It is our
position. Although a brief is pretty tangible. I have to carry around all too much tangible legal services. gets the services and cheated out of the excess.
Our position is that what the city contracted for was not merely legal services, but conflict-free legal services,
well,
and it never happened.
You could say just the same thing for the highway. What the city contracted for was not just a highway, but a conflict-free highway.
Well,
you choke at that.
I have
you?
A little difficulty with that concept, but I don't have difficulty.
Legal services. I certainly appreciate that the rules of professional responsibility require conflict-free representation, but suppose, just hypothetically, one of the things that the Gulata firm did was take a case all the way to the Supreme Court for the city of Calumet City and win. Now, surely we can't say that that was worth nothing, even though they had this conflict because of the secret relationship with Mayor Geneva. For all we know, I mean, and indeed the record seems to suggest that they were chugging along doing ordinary legal services, and the city council, somebody must have known. I don't know whether the city council's records show which law firms are being hired and how much is going out. Most public entities have budgets and lists like that. And it was in the Gulata firm's interest to actually do the best they could, or they'd lose the business, I assume. Maybe they did fine.
No, Your Honor, I don't think there was very much chance, as long as Jerry Geneva was in office, that the Gulata firm was going to lose the city's business. But again, I come back, and I don't want to be repeating myself, but I come back to the point that when you're hiring a lawyer, you are, what you're investing in, what you're putting your money into is that fiduciary relationship. And if that is betrayed and compromised from the beginning, then you're just not getting what you're paying for. You can't trust an advisor and counselor that you're paying professional fees to for that very professional service because of the conflict of interest.
Isn't there a bit of a windfall there, though? I mean, perhaps even there's a discount that's appropriate because of that. But if they're winning the litigation for you, how are you harmed, monetarily at least, in a forfeiture sense?
Well, again, you're in the forfeiture sense, you are harmed from the standpoint that, even if you're winning in litigation, you are represented by what is supposed to be a trusted fiduciary who cannot be a trusted fiduciary.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Before you sit down, let me ask one more question along these lines. Suppose we have a real fiduciary, that is a trustee of a trust, bound by the normal trust laws. Trustee can't trade for his own benefit using trust assets. But the trustee violates that rule, takes $100,000 from the trust, you know, buys some stock for his own account, makes a profit of $20,000, you know, pays $100,000 for the stock, sells it for $120,000, makes a profit of $20,000 for himself. And how much does the trust get?
Your Honor, I would say all of it.
$120,000.
Yes.
That is, it's not enough that he's paid the $100,000 back to the trust, so it's even.
That's correct.
The trust then gets $120,000, the whole amount he sold the stock for.
I believe so.
I don't think that's compatible with principles of trust law. And we could check this out. But
trust law is outside my area of expertise, Your Honor.
But that was the analogy you were using, that an attorney is like a trustee, is a fiduciary for the city.
That's correct.
And that would distinguish this case from the highway case, where the construction contractor is not a fiduciary.
I believe so.
But then I think in order to figure out principles of forfeiture, we probably need to go to trust law. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Sklarsky, anything further? You must have about 18 and a half seconds. Let me very quickly address the spillover argument, and Justice Wood, your argument, your
Judge,
question,
yes.
Judge Wood, your question mm-hmm. on where in the indictment, how do we know this is the scheme? Page 12 of the indictment is the first mail fraud count. Page 13. It says that this mailing is for purpose of executing the above-described scheme. And if you go back to page 9 of the indictment, the above-described scheme is the attorney fees kickback scheme. It's not easy to discern because it's put in a label, in a bold print label at the top, and then all the allegations follow. But there was no question that these mailings were in furtherance of the attorney fees kickback scheme. The indictment says it. That's the way it was argued at trial. That's the way the evidence was presented. So that there is a spillover. If they think there was bribery because of the filing of the false statement, it infects the mail fraud, just as it did the bribery convictions themselves. As to the forfeiture, there was...
Thank you, Counsel.
Sorry. Mr. Hill, anything further?
Yes. In response to the argument that was made regarding the fact, counsel's use of Reeves, Ernst Young, to say that you can influence the enterprise through a bribery, he makes it, again, a general proposition because it goes further than that. The RICO statute requires a nexus between the predicate act and the affairs of the enterprise. In Blackwood, the United States versus Blackwood, you had a situation where the defendant police officer assigned to traffic court as a court sergeant was convicted of receiving bribes to influence the disposition of traffic tickets. The bribe was paid to influence his activity with respect to the enterprise. In this case, assuming there was a bribe, it wasn't paid to influence the activities of the enterprise. His use of Reeves is misplaced in the context of the facts of this case. I may be pronouncing it either Revis or Reeves versus Ernst Young. I mean, you've got to show that there's a nexus between the bribe, which impacts upon the enterprise. And I think Blackwood, United States versus Blackwood, this circuit said in 1985 that that was the case.
Thank you, Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Martin, anything further?
Just a few points. Teach two classes and it's RICO. The reason for our argument, in part, is to prevent innocent conduct from being criminalized. The Supreme Court, just in the last month or so, in Shiler, recognized that it's important to make distinctions between the crimes that are charged as part of a RICO. And in that case, they said the conduct may have been a coercion, but it wasn't Hobbs Act. And it's like what we're saying here. The conduct may have been theft. It may have been mail fraud. It's not Illinois bribery. It's important here because you can't get to a RICO by the two Section 66 counts or theft under state law. The government in their argument relied upon the district court's rationale, so that's what we relied upon for saying this is bribery, but the district court itself said, I don't see this as a bribery case. This is a very significant issue. It will engender significant issues post-trial, and that's the transcript at page 3, 2, 1, 4, and 5. If the case, Your Honors, on the cross appeal is talking about is Sims, I would just note it wasn't cited in the government's brief, but I did bring it to this court's authority. I tried to distinguish it. I guess I didn't do a real good job, but that's it.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Sklarsky and Mr. Hill, the court particularly appreciates your willingness to take the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been to your client and to us. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.